Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the United States Senator from the state of Maine, which has produced more great politicians. This one is Angus King. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Harvest Host, Miracle Made, and ZBiotics. They're in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. James, I'm going to try something slightly different this week. There's so much happened. I'm just going to kind of, in shorthand form, go through five or six things and then turn it over to you. And you tell me what it all means. Trump accepts a $400 million superjet for his presidential and then personal use from Qatar. A gift of that size is not only unethical, it should violate the Constitution's emoluments clause. But Trump said, Sam Snead used to say, when they give you a putt, you always take it. The biographer of Sam Snead said that Snead never said that. Trump is shaking down his cryptocurrency investors, where the Trumps may walk away with billions and some of the suckers get stuck with a bill. With fanfare and an adoring Robert F. Kennedy by his side, he signed an executive order that he says is going to dramatically reduce drug prices, except it won't. It has no teeth and it was embraced by pharma. The big drug lobbying firm. Trump and congressional Republicans are assembling the big, beautiful budget bill, which they say is going to be painless, except about 8 million Americans would lose their health coverage, some nursing homes would close due to Medicaid changes, and $5 trillion would be added to the budget, while the rich people get to keep their tax loopholes, including the indefensible private equity carried interest loophole. I'm almost finished. Trump, accompanied by business lackeys, including the publisher of the LA Times, is in Saudi Arabia with everyone praising the Saudi Crown Prince, MBS, who you may remember only about 6 years ago ordered the execution and dismemberment of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Finally, Ed Martin, who was too dumb or unqualified to become U.S. attorney in Washington, has just been given, that's a job really for a Fox News host, has just been given a new job at the Trump subsidiary, the Justice Department, and he's going to review all the pardons that Biden gave, but not Trump's. So putting this all together, James, tell us what it all means.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's just talk about corruption, okay? This is what we know now. Do you think they're going to stop? Of course not. It's going to continue to get worse. That's why I think the Democrats, we've talked about this, need a simple thing to explain. As I understand it, the way that ethics works in the federal government is federal employees have a code of ethics. Actually, congressional members have probably not the strongest thing you've ever seen, but they do have one. And there's not very much that applies to the executive branch. So Democrats should be for proposal, say the code of ethics of federal employees should apply to every person employed by the federal government up to and including the president. Why can a meat inspector in Minneapolis not take a bribe from Hormel, but the president of the United States can essentially take a bribe from Qatar? It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense. And they said, well, it might be a constitutional issue. You might be a troop. Oh, shit. The executive branch prosecutes people from the legislative branch all the time. Look at, Ozzie Myers or any number of other instances. Let them explain that. You can't tell me that we live in a country where a meat inspector, a park ranger, airline controller. So should we let United Airlines pay an airline controller to make sure that its plane land ahead of American planes or Delta planes? Of course not. We would be outraged. That would be illegal. Couldn't do that. You're not supposed to do that. Yet, this, and you're watching it just right in front of you, that's selling the meme coin or whatever they call it, and inviting the people to the White House, selling places at the White House Easter egg roll. It's so staggering. You can't believe it, but you got to stay on it. And I think the plane actually broke through. I don't think that's even close to the worst thing they've ever done, but it broke through. And we should stay on it, but what will happen, don't fear it, I almost know it, is we're going to get distracted by something else. And what he does is he puts these tariffs out. Okay, you had maybe the greatest capitulation you've ever had in a trade negotiation, where he just tells the Chinese, fuck it, we're not going to do anything. Just sign. He tells the Treasury Secretary, just sign anything. And it's been. So what does he do the next day? He says, I'm going to lower the price of prescription drugs by 80 or 90%. He has no intention of doing that. He puts that out. So the people are calling and says, we don't be a panel to talk about his drug proposal plan. The Democrats are really careful because people like lower price prescription. He's not serious. I know the guy that he talked to. I'm 90% sure. I'll tell you his name next week. Who said he was fat and he was in London. And a guy said, I need to get medicine here. It costs $800 and it costs, I don't know, $3,000 in the U.S. So he put something out. So we forget about the capitulation on the trade deal, and then we're talking about that. That's what he does with green. That's what he does with Panama Canal or Canada or any of the other goofy shit that he comes up with. He just distracts you from the fact of all of the failures he had. And goddammit, it works again. They're actually taking it seriously. It's just all bullshit stacked on bullshit stacked on bullshit. And until people learn to treat it like that, and as if he's going to annex the Panama Canal, or Canada's going to be the 51st state. I mean, get fucking real. But he certainly does drive the conversation.
James, you're right. As I understand the ethics thing, actually, the executive branch has pretty tough ethics rules. They just don't apply to the president or the vice president. So okay. I'm gonna try to write a column that says, I think every congressional, I'm stealing this from Grover Norquist, who did it in a bad way. He would come out with a little postcard, and you had to agree you weren't going to increase taxes. I think you can put an anti-corruption postcard, one sentence apiece. A, all the federal executive ethics and conflict of interest rules apply to the president and vice president. B, members of Congress cannot trade stocks. C, that all federal contributions ought to be disclosed. And D, the Supreme Court should follow the same ethics and conflict of interest as other courts. One sentence apiece, everyone, it's all anti-corruption. They can't say it's intended just for Republicans. It affects Democrats too, because I do think it's resonating. I think the plane, which I agree with you, was not nearly as bad as the crypto scam they're pulling off, but people understand it, and I think give a postcard to every congressional candidate and then publicize. Do they sign it or not? Because I think that usually I'm skeptical of how big an issue it is, but I think you're right. This is really broken through.
The thing about the issue is it's going to keep coming because right, they're corrupt right, and they're not going to stop being corrupt. All right. So just play to the cup. It's coming more your way. And I think people, you know, we keep saying to get away with it. He has gone from 52 to 40. All right. People are noticing something. And we got to keep plowing on, you know. And again, last night, you know, in Omaha, at 12 years of a Republican mayor, the Democrat won by 8. Don Bacon he's burnt. He's burnt. For yeah. Sure.
Yeah. James, I'm going to recommend everyone out there. I'm going to plug another outlet, The Atlantic, Digital Atlantic. Right. There's a piece that written by J. Michael Luttig, who was one of the most revered conservative U.S. Court of Appeals, highly almost made the Supreme Court under Bush. And he has written a piece called The End of the Rule of Law in America that goes through everything Trump has done. And we've talked about this before. He does so much, as you said today. You know, today he'll do some phony healthcare thing. Then he'll talk about Greenland. Then he'll talk about something else. Luttig really carefully outlines all of the not just bad things he's done, unconstitutional and illegal things, and it's titled The End of the Rule of Law in America. It really is worth a read.
Yeah, this is what I think. I think I'm going to make an assignment to myself. I'm going to read it very carefully. I'm going to read it five times. But I hope that a lot of our listeners read it and key off on the questions of what do they find most egregious about this. Because, it's like we say, it's a little bit like you're a mosquito in a nudist colony. What fat butt do you land on? And that's always the triage to say what are the two or three most glaring things that the public can relate to. And sometimes the public doesn't always relate to the biggest crime. It's the most understandable. And the airplane is certainly something that people understand.
Right.
But we just got to keep minding this. And I want to read Judge Luttig's piece five times to siphon through it. And you're right. The guy was like, was being on the Supreme Court, almost buzzed. He was general counsel of Boeing. He was, I don't know how many years, a federal appellate judge. I mean, he's a legal scholar. And he's a lifelong Republican conservative. But I mean, some things are too much for some people, and they're too much for him.
Well, he entitles it The End of the Rule of Law in America, and it's devastating for Trump. Lawless, he says almost every order he has issued, every major order is unconstitutional. He really has no right. He doesn't have the right to do tariffs. He doesn't have the right to do anything. And he also goes after some of those people that capitulated, like the law firms, who he says disgraced their own lawyers in the legal profession and their clients. And I think he's right on that. So it's a piece, again, it's The Atlantic, The End of the Rule of Law. And if you can't do it, read it five times, read it three or four times.
Right. This is a mandatory assignment.
Right. So, next week, we're going to have a question and answer session on it.
Yes, absolutely.
James, we're overlooking just briefly some of the other things. They're putting together this big, bad, beautiful budget deal. It's not up there. And it's a fraud. It's, again, a fraud. It's just not going to hurt anybody. We've cut back on it. But you know. Yeah, it's not going to hurt anybody except 7.5 million people are going to lose their health care coverage. It's going to increase the deficit by $5 trillion. Nursing homes are going to close. But, you know, it's not going to hurt anybody, James.
This is a question. You're much more covered, many more budgets and things like this. What happens if there's some chance this doesn't work? All right, it just is. And I don't know what they're going to do. And I don't know. I'm curious to see how they're going to. The Medicaid stuff is already just blowing up everywhere. A lot of people are not going to go along with it. What happened? This guy, Don Bacon, he's got to be like shitting in his pants right now, as are any number of people. And I don't know. I don't know. And they got that ceiling, the amount that they're adding to the deficit is going to be. And, but you know, we'll have obviously a good talk with Senator King about this. They got a tough summer. You mean they got a tough summer and they got to have a tough fall coming up, particularly with Virginia.
And it's Democratic opportunities. You don't have to lay out a 7-point plan. You don't have to say, here's the way we'd govern. You have to say, here's what we won't do, because what we're doing is better, because it is really awful. Remember all the talk from Trump a couple of weeks ago? Well, maybe we ought to tax the rich more. Oh,
that he doesn't mean that.
It got lost.
Right. And then they say, at least Trump is willing to do it. He's not. I mean, that's like the prescription drug. It's all bullshit. Everything is bullshit. There's nothing that's not. We gotta learn to quit chasing this.
Right.
I mean, you've covered Washington, so there's no way. And of course, now you got Josh Hawley saying no way to cut Medicaid. All right. I mean, what are they going to do?
Two big issues, and the others are all subsidiary. Number one, the economy and his broken promises. His total broken promise. Remember, he was going to fix inflation on day one. He was going to do also, and he was going to have a big, beautiful plan. And number two, corruption. And actually, they go together. And, don't get distracted. You're right.
They make a big deal of some drop in inflation, right? The inflation rate was dropping before he took office. If anything,
But tariffs haven't hit yet, James. I mean, that was.
I understand. But I'm just saying what people are going to say.
Right.
All right. Don't get distracted from the criminality or the difficulty or it, what they're having to cobble together over the summer.
Right. We have one of the most interesting guests in American politics, the senator from Maine, Angus King. Senator, in a reprise of Maine's Margaret Shea Smith's famous Declaration of Conscience 75 years ago, you issued yours, I've read it now twice, and you said quite directly, Donald Trump is violating the Constitution and the rule of law, brushing aside separation of powers. Congress, the United States Senate, could stop some of this. Yet, as you say, it has been complicit. Why?
Well, you know the answer to that. You guys know a lot about politics. This is all about Republican primaries. And my colleagues, I think part of the problem, Al, is that people around here are looking on this as just politics as usual. You know, this is the usual pushing and hauling between the administration, the president, and the Congress. And, you know, we're arguing about immigration and various issues that have been around for a long time. The problem is they're ignoring the fact that there's something much deeper and more serious that's going on, which is this whole unitary executive idea and the idea that the president basically has all the power. It's very telling that this president has only signed 5 bills in the first 100 days. I mean, that used to be the measure of how much legislation. And I ran across an amazing thing online the other day where he was just going on and on criticizing Obama for signing executive orders and saying this shows he can't get anything done. Well, they've done nothing but executive orders. One substantive bill, the Riley-Lakin Act, not a very good one. And then the continuing resolution and three, CRAs, Congressional Review Act. So basically, practically no legislative output. The problem, fellas, is this is exactly what the framers of the Constitution were worried about. When you get all power into one set of hands, it's dangerous. It's dangerous for everybody. And it's dangerous for the people that are egging on the president right now. At some point, they're going to say, wait a minute, we didn't really mean for him to be able to deport people because what's on their Facebook page or whatever next is going to be next after tattoos. This is a fundamental collapsing of our structure of checks and balances, and it's just plain dangerous for the American people. And that's I'm trying to sound the alarm. My wife says I'm a combination of Paul Revere and Chicken Little. I'm trying to get people to pay attention to this problem. But right now, the loyalty to party is overcoming loyalty to the Constitution.
We'll stick with the Paul Revere. We have been promoting a wonderful article that came out today in The Atlantic by Judge Michael Luttig, a conservative icon, and it is entitled, Senator, The End of the Rule of Law in America. I mean, to have a conservative jurist say there is the end of the rule of law, and he says that almost every major signature thing that Trump has done is unconstitutional. That's stunning. And I want to ask you, you've always been a come let us reason together guy. You work with people on both sides of the aisle. You're an independent. But now is the time to really get a lot tougher, a lot meaner. Chuck Schumer, for instance, says that he's going to hold up all of his DOJ nominees until he explains or gives in on accepting that $400 million airplane. I mean, are there things that you guys can do that'll make it harder for him?
Well, there are things that can be done, but, you know, you guys know American politics. They have the votes. There are procedural things, for example, holding up nominees. And by the way, there was a debate on the floor yesterday where one of my Republican colleagues was saying, this is unheard of. Nobody, we've never done anything like this in 50 years. Well, what about Tommy Tuberville and the generals? I mean, you know, that was a straight up obstruction for no good reason. But yeah, there are things that can be done. But ultimately, it's the Republicans who have to step up and honor the oath that they took to the Constitution. And it's all right. Now, a couple of things might happen or will happen, I think. The president's going to overreach, and finally, it's going to start impacting people at home. When the first Social Security check is late, or people can't get through to the VA to get a medical appointment because they've cut the staff so thoroughly, when those kinds of things start happening back home, then the senators here, the legislators, the congressmen people are going to start to say, well, wait a minute, this isn't going to help me, you know, a year and a half from now. I'm going to have to start separating myself. And I'm seeing that starting to happen. We had a bipartisan bill with, I think, 7 or 8 Republican co-sponsors on bringing the tariff power back to the Congress. That was a, I would call it a green shoot, a kind of early indication that maybe this lockstep following of whatever the president wants to do is starting to wear a little thin with these folks.
Let me, did Trump blink on tariffs this week with China?
Look to me like it. I mean, that was my question is, aren't we pretty much back where we were 6 months ago? And it was sort of a double blink, if you will. Perhaps that isn't the right word, but the tariff sort of went back to, as I say, where they were before all this started. And then, but to make it worse, he said, well, this is for 90 days. And that's what businesses don't like, is the uncertainty. If they're going to make a deal, let's make a deal and get it done. I spent a lot of my life in private business. You want to know what the rules are a year from now and 2 years from now, let alone a couple of weeks from now. So the fact that he made this, whatever the deal is with China, it doesn't appear to be, as I say, anything very significant in terms of where we already were. But then he wants to... He stretches it out and gives us another 90 days of uncertainty. The whole tariff thing is a good example as to why the framers put the tariff power in Congress's hands and not one person's hand. And unfortunately, Congress delegated it, but only for emergencies. And of course, he called anything he wants an emergency. I can tell you,
right,
from a state next to Canada, there's no emergency at the Canadian border.
You're not worried about the Canadian Mounties coming over and attacking.
Well, there is a concern that they'll come across the border and be nice and give us free health care. I mean, you got to be careful.
Let me ask you. Let me go back to the corruption for a minute. That airplane, $400 million for his presidential use and then his personal use from Qatar. They'll get something for that. I mean, doesn't this have the appearance of a bribe?
I don't know if I'd use that word, but I'd certainly say it has the appearance of an illegal gift. The Constitution is very clear. The president can't accept a gift from a foreign state without the approval of Congress. And this is the mother of all gifts, $400 million. But listen, there's a big national security issue here. Imagine for a minute if the Qataris came and said, we'd like to remodel the Oval Office, the Situation Room, and the residence at the White House, and we're going to rewire it and remodel it. We'd say, you're out of your mind. We can't allow you to do that. Well, that's what Air Force One is. It's a combination of the Situation Room, the Oval Office, and the residential. And in order to accept this, if we have any sense, we'd have to practically take that plane apart to be sure that it's not bugged in some way. This is the same country that supports Hamas. You know, the Hamas leadership that isn't in Gaza is in Qatar, and it smells bad on all fronts. And of course, it's people don't give you a $400 million gift and expect nothing in return.
Let me ask just one more and turn it over to James. You in that speech, that speech that you gave on almost the 75th anniversary of Margaret J. Smith, which you knew, you actually did a documentary on her. But you also talked about the actions that he's taking against private companies, the media and the law firms, which are virtually unprecedented and outrageous. But those big New York and Chicago law firms capitulated. They could have stood up like Wilmer Hale and others, maybe cut their bonuses in half. I mean, when you talk about profiles and cowardice, don't you have to add those big law firms?
Well, I think they made a big mistake. You never get anywhere, sitting on top of the tiger. You're going to get eaten in the end. And I think what they thought was that they thought, well, he wants a commitment for pro bono work. We already do a lot of pro bono work, so that's sort of a no big deal. What they didn't realize is he expects pro bono work that he defines of what he mm-hmm. asks. And it was, it was a terrible mistake for those firms to do that. And I think it was a terrible mistake for Columbia University to fold. The old saying in Maine is if you give a moose a cookie, you know, what's going to happen? You're going to run out of cookies pretty soon. And this guy's just going to keep coming back and coming back. But let me take it back a little bit, Al, and talk about why this is so serious. Article 2 of the Constitution is very limited. That's what defines the presidential power. He only has one unilateral power in Article 2. That's the power of pardons. Nobody can check that. Everything else, even commander-in-chief in war, Congress has the power to declare war. All the other powers of appointing judges and everything else are subject to congressional control. But here's the key that really, you get to the law firm stuff, the university stuff, the collapsing of agencies. The principal responsibility in the Constitution in Article 2 of the president says he has the responsibility to, quote, see that the laws are faithfully executed. Period. Not see that the laws he likes are faithfully executed. And by the way, an appropriations bill is a law. It's not something that the president can pick and choose and say, well, I like this program, I'm going to fund it. I don't like this one, I'm going to cut it. That's not the way the whole thing is designed for a reason. Because these people knew in 1787 that it was dangerous for any individual to have all the power. Power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's 1,000 years of human nature talking to us.
Sure is. James Carville.
So, Senator King, the saying is there's a new senorita coming to town, and her name is Rosie Scenario.
Yeah.
And if you look at the whole Build Back Better, or what they're doing, and I'm going to bring up a term we don't talk about very much more, is the debt and the deficit. Unchecked. Where are we heading to? What kind of, if they pass these tax cuts and they pass the stuff that they're talking about, don't you being a kind of Yankee, kind of skeptical look at things, does the deficit starting to play into your thinking about the future of the country? And can this stuff really, really come back and, frankly, just bite us on the ass?
Absolutely, James. And where we are is, we're approaching, and I think we've actually exceeded 100% of our GDP as our debt. That's sort of a red flag. And you talked about Rosie's scenario. I don't know if you're aware, but the Republicans in the Senate changed the rules, and they said all these Trump tax cuts expire this year. So current law has always been the way you define spending and tax bills. You know, what's current law? So current law is they're going to expire, and if they extend them, it's going to, on the books, will cost $4.5 trillion. So they've invented something new called current policy. And what they're saying is that extending what's current policy, even though it expires at the end of the year, is a sort of magical way of saying it's not going to cost anything. I mean, I'm not making this up. It's a fantasy in terms of arithmetic, because we're still going to have to borrow the money. The short answer to your question is it's a serious problem. There are lots of pieces to it, but one of the pieces, fellas, is revenues. The average of federal revenues over the past 30 or 40 years is around 20% of GDP. And expenditures have been around 21 or 22% of GDP. That's the deficit. Now, revenues are something like 16% of GDP as a result of the Bush and the Trump tax cuts. And that's the big, huge deficit. You know, 5%, 6% of GDP is a big number. And you add it up every year. And interest in I think, next year or the year after, interest on our debt will exceed the defense budget. That's dead money. That's not money that's buying anything for the American people. In fact, a lot of it's going overseas. So the answer is, yes, it's a serious problem. But I'm troubled by the idea that the only way to solve it is to drastically cut spending. And I got to add one thing, and I know I'm talking too much. Firing a lot of federal workers doesn't save much in the way of money. That's a show. You could fire 1/3 of all federal workers and reduce the federal budget by 1%. So this whole DOGE thing is fake.
So Senator, what they're proposing, the analogy that I use, let's say I send my daughter to Bowdoin College in Maine. It's very expensive, okay? So I'm planning, let's just...
I used to teach there, James, so she'll get a hell of an education.
Okay. let's say I pay full fare, I'm paying $70,000 times four is $280,000. So my daughter graduates and she said, Dad, give me $70,000 a year because I just graduated, so you don't do that. So it doesn't really cost you anything if every 4 years you give me $280,000. That's the logic of what they're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. And I've confronted them about it on the floor, and they just sort of smile and roll their eyes, and you know they know it's nonsense what they're doing.
Right, but we just got to explain to people how much nonsense this is, because they'll use well according to current policy if you add, and they'll just obfuscate it. So what you're saying is I got to keep paying my children the same amount of money I paid them to send to school. Or I finish paying my mortgage, I ought to just keep paying because it doesn't cost me.
Yeah, that's a good way to analogize it. That's exactly the argument. And listen, I'm not sitting here saying, you know, you got to raise taxes, but I'm saying you can't talk about this subject, because here's the other thing about the budget. I'm gonna bore you for a minute.
No, bores.
Domestic spending, domestic discretionary spending, Department of the Interior, Agriculture, Justice, you know, all the stuff you think of as a federal government, is absolutely flat for the past 60 years as a percentage of GDP. It's about 4% of GDP back in the 60s, 4% of GDP today. Defense, and this will surprise you, defense spending as a percent of GDP has gone down from 9% to about 3%. So defense spending as a proportion of our economy has gone down almost 2/3. People are surprised to hear that. They always talk about we spend more than any other country, all the other countries combined, but it's way less than we were spending back in the 60s and 70s. Where the growth in the budget is, of course, is in what are called is mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, federal healthcare costs, veterans costs. That's what's driving the budget, and what's driving that is mostly healthcare, because we spend twice as much per capita as anybody in the world for healthcare, and that's what's driving that deficit. Back in the 60s and 70s, the discretionary budget that Congress controlled was about 70% of the total budget. Today, it's flipped. The discretionary budget is 30% of the federal budget, and 70% is in the so-called entitlements. Why are the entitlements so high? Number one is healthcare, as I mentioned. The other is demographics. 10,000 people a day are qualifying for Medicare. I mean, think about that for a minute. So the demographics are driving it too. And, you know, this is a complicated problem that we need to look at spending for sure. But as I say, firing a bunch of federal workers is only going to compromise services, and it isn't going to save a hell of a lot of money. And you can't talk about this without talking about revenues.
How essential is Medicaid to the health insurance profile in the state of Maine? What would happen if we just eradicated it?
It would be catastrophic. Something like 250,000 to 300,000 people would lose their coverage overnight. And a lot of people think of Medicaid as, you know, for moms on welfare with little kids. But 70% of the nursing home beds in Maine are paid for by Medicaid, 70%. So you're talking about Aunt Minnie and your mother and, you know, your Uncle Charlie, and that's a huge part of the Medicaid budget. Kids are a big part of it. And frankly, you guys are the political analysts. I've never understood why there are certain people in this country that seem hell-bent to take health insurance away from people. I just don't get it. I don't understand the ideology. I feel very strongly about it. My life was saved because I had health insurance and had an early intervention and found cancer and was treated. And if I hadn't had that health insurance, I wouldn't be here today. So the idea of taking health insurance away from people is cruel, number one, but it's also bad policy. Healthy people are able to work and pay taxes.
There's a book called The Cruelty is the Point. That's actually the point, is that it's cruel. Don't ever underestimate that.
Well, some of the things that are going on, cutting AmeriCorps. I mean, here, thousands of young people that are volunteering, working public service, they don't get paid much at all. So it's a very low cost, but they're eliminating it. Why? Because they don't like public service, I guess. I mean, as you say, cruelty seems to be the point.
I'm going to turn back over to Al Baker. If I made this point with Senator Bennett, I've been swapping phone calls with Senator Warner. I'd make the same one to him, but I'll just make it to you publicly. You're right. We don't have a majority. We can't pass anything, but we can make them vote on things.
Absolutely.
Make them vote to return the power tariffs to Congress. Make them vote on the ethics code for the president. Get people and say, okay, you don't want to do this. We're going to make you take votes.
And that's exactly what's happening. In fact, Tim Kaine is going to have a vote. We're looking for what are called privilege resolutions, resolutions that we can bring to the floor without the say-so of the majority leader. Tim's bringing up one next week to require the State Department to give us a human rights analysis of El Salvador. We'll see how they vote on that one.
Right. Okay. Well, that's my advice to the senator. Maybe you can't pass anything, but you can make them vote on stuff, and they're going to squirm. You know, way back then. Albert?
Senator, among your areas of expertise are armed services and intelligence. You served on those committees. You voted against Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard. You've seen them now. You were talking about cuts. They are cutting the intelligence force. Hegseth is changing the military force. Is that endangering national security?
I think it is. I think, you know, intelligence, if you go back to the sort of national security disasters of Vietnam and Iraq, they were based upon bad intelligence, that the intelligence of what was really happening on the ground wasn't getting through. I went back a year or so ago and reread The Best and the Brightest, David Halberstam's brilliant book about Vietnam. And the part of the problem was that the intelligence was being cooked to suit the demands of McNamara and Johnson. Same thing with Iraq when they were telling President Bush that there were weapons of mass destruction. So cutting the intelligence community and cutting their capacity to analyze problems is a real loss. Here's an interesting one. Every year at the Intelligence Committee, we have something called the Worldwide Threats Hearing. And every year, the leadership of the intelligence community and all the agencies come before the committee, and they go through, they produce a report about here are the things that are dangerous in the world that are causing us problems. I think every year for like the past 7 or 8 years, climate change has been one of the threats because it leads to migration, it leads to famine, it leads to instability. It's a threat multiplier in terms of national security. Guess what? This year, it wasn't in the report at all. Zero, gone. So that's an example of politics and ideology snuffing out intelligence that can be important in terms of making the country more secure. And the other piece in the Pentagon, of course, they're talking about 8 or 10% reduction. And what bothers me about that is if you start with a number, that almost tells you in advance that it's not a rational process. If you want to reduce the size of the bureaucracy, which I'm not necessarily against, it should be done by an analysis of, we know which jobs are important, which are not so important, who's doing their job, who's productive, who's not. But when you start at the beginning and say we're going to reduce by 8%, almost by definition, you're not going to have a rational process to get there. And, you know, firing probationary officers all throughout the government, that's like telling people to count off by threes. One, I'm a one, two, three. Okay, all you twos are fired. I mean, it made no sense. And it's actually, I think, going to cost us more money than it's going to save.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. Let me go back to Margaret Chase Smith. McCarthy wreaked damage for almost 4 years after her her amazing speech on the Senate floor. I have a good friend, Larry Tye, who wrote a terrific biography of Joe McCarthy, and he reminds us that his reign of terror ended in 1954, but the damage lasted for decades. Do you think the damage that Trump is inflicting now is going to take that long or longer to recover from?
I'm afraid I do. It depends, Al, on whether there's any effort made to stop it now rather than wait until, you know, another election or even 3 years from now. I think that's the real that's the real question, and the jury is out on that. Will my colleagues finally wake up and realize that this isn't politics as usual? Listen, I don't care if the Archangel Gabriel is the president. They shouldn't have this kind of power. And the Republicans are going to regret it if there's a Democratic president, and the principle has been established that, you know, you can ignore congressional appropriations, and you don't have to you can abolish an agency created by Congress. All of those things are dangerous. Whoever's in the job, we can debate the president's agenda. I don't agree with much of it, but we can debate it. It's the way he's going about it. By circumventing the constitutional checks and balances, the rule of law, and now, you know, he's had an outstanding unanimous Supreme Court decision for about a month on this guy in El Salvador, and basically they're just ignoring it. So, You know, that's the other leg of the triangle here is the courts, and they're doing a pretty good job of stepping up. But the question is, are these folks going to obey those decisions? And you know, it's pretty awful when they're talking about impeaching judges. No, I'm a lawyer. If you don't like the decision, you appeal it. You don't impeach the judge.
Right. You know, your terrific communications person, Matt Felling, warned me, don't ask him questions about partisan politics. That's not what he's into. But I do have one. Do you have a favorite candidate for governor of Maine next year?
Well, there's some guy who has a similar name to mine. Actually, it's my son is running for governor, and it's pretty cool. His motto is, "I'm the Angus King who was born in Maine," which I think is sort of a smart comment. But yeah, he's a good guy. He just announced last week, and he's off and running. He's serious about it.
And he's running as a D.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you something. I'll go campaign with him with the Cajuns in Northern Maine.
There you go. They are up at. That's right. In Madawaska and Fort Kent. We got up there is the Cajuns.
Yeah, I'll come up. I'll show up and go campaign with him in a general election.
All right.
So I have just one thing before I let you go, Senator. You were two times governor of Maine. You've been a senator for a while. You've studied and you've observed American politics. You're very in tune with history of the country. And I keep hearing and keep believing this is the worst. Actually, I'm more scared. I'm 80 years old. I was born the same year you were, 1944. I was born October 25th, which was the date of the first kamikaze attack at Lady Gulf. Mm-hmm. I have never been more afraid for our country than I am now, ever, in my 80 years, which is about the same time as you. Yeah. Do you think that myself and people that feel like that are justified, that the whole thing could just blow a gasket the way we're going?
I think it's the most serious assault on the Constitution in the history of the country. The Civil War was a division of the country. That was certainly the most serious crisis the country's ever faced. But in terms of the structure of the Constitution, the way it works, checks and balances, the protections that the framers built in, I think it's the most serious challenge we've ever faced. And that's what I'm trying to wake my colleagues up. And like I say, James, everybody's treating this as politics as usual. You know, they say, well, King is just trying to undermine Trump, or Schumer's trying to undermine Trump. This is a qualitatively different situation than an argument about immigration or voting rights or guns or whatever it is. By the way, James, if anybody asked you, which they asked me when I was running last year, you should tell them you're a year younger than Mick Jagger. That worked for me, man.
Now I know I've been verified that I have really good reason to be really scared.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. It is a very serious moment, and what worries me is that it will take some real catastrophe to to wake people up. I've been in touch with my Republican colleagues one by one, and they basically say, well, you know, it's a problem, but the courts will take care of it, or, you know, just we'll get through this. This isn't typical. This isn't normal. And speaking of normal, what should scare us is that dictatorships, pharaohs, kings, czars, emperors, that's normal in world history. What we have is an anomaly. What we have is a very unusual blip in history that's lasted a couple of hundred years, but it's not assured by any means whatsoever. And if we start to allow all power to devolve into one set of hands, that's a sure recipe. Well, Madison summed it up. He said, when you have legislative, executive, and judicial power in one set of hands, that's a perfect description of tyranny. He used the word tyranny. He didn't mince words. And he said, liberty can't survive if you have legislative and executive power in one set of hands. We ought to be listening. History, our framers, the Constitution are shouting at us that this is a dangerous moment.
Well, thank you, Senator. I can't wait to have one of the most insightful people in American politics, and all you people that come up to an airport and say, Mr. Carville, I'm really afraid. I'm going to say Senator King is too. So you got company out there and you have reason to be afraid.
Well, I also want to ask, just urge everyone out there, we're making reading assignments today. Read Angus King's Declaration of Conscience following on Margaret Chase Smith 75 years ago. Wonderful speech he gave in the Senate just a few days ago. It's easily accessible, and everybody out there ought to read it. Senator, thank you so very much.
Thanks, fellow.
And I'm glad to know Maine finally has a chance to vote for a king who was born there.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I got to tell you, before we sign off, I got to tell you, I was at one of the big hands-off rallies the other day in Maine, and somebody had a sign that said, we don't vote for kings. Or no, we don't want kings except Angus and Stephen. I like that one. Anyway, thanks so much, fellas. Great to be with you.
Thank you.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week, James. Over 10 years ago, at the urgings of Senator Jack Reed, a Rhode Island senator and graduate of the United States Military Academy, I spent more than 3 days at West Point lecturing, learning, and hanging out with those young cadets. I was dazzled at their character and commitment, also at the excellence of the academic environment. With the exception of the discipline they have up there, you could have been at Duke or Yale or any place else. The service academies have done an extraordinary job over the past 40 years, diversifying the Corps and Brigade, prepared to serve in a non-white world while elevating their academic standards. Trump and his pitiful defense secretary, Hegseth, are imperiling this as they seek to politicize the environments at West Point and Annapolis and Colorado Springs. I recommend reading the New York Times piece by Graham Parsons, a philosophy professor at West Point. Hegseth, he writes, is banning books, eliminating courses, censoring speech. He thinks these impressive young men and women have to be sheltered. They can't handle discussions or courses on gender ideology or the history of racism. They can't read Toni Morrison or James Baldwin. As Professor Parsons, who is resigning after 13 years at the Academy, notes, quote, cadets are constantly told they are to lead a life of honor, to choose the harder right over the easier wrong, to have moral courage. Under the Trump-Hegseth plan, these are just empty slogans, and not only an outrage, but an insult to these brave and bright young women and men at West Point and Annapolis.
You know, I read that same thing, at West Point guy, and I think the point you make is so good. There's a million things I could be outraged about, but I think that our listeners would be good to sort of reflect on that. Now, I just had an experience. I did this like town hall thing with Chris Cuomo, Bill O'Reilly, Governor Sununu was there, Ronald McDaniel, Trump actually was there. And it started on DEI. And I said, I'll tell you what, you know, we're really practicing DEI. It's Military Academy, Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, Coast Guard Academy. I said, but when I taught at Tulane, there were two ways you could get in my class. If you were black or you were conservative. Because I didn't want, I don't understand. They talk about is meritorious. Well, define merit to me. So if somebody makes a higher SAT score and they come from a fluent, you know, from Bethesda or something, and they scored 15% higher than the guy who lived in the back of a car, all right? So I don't even know when they say that, what's the definition of merit? And I wanted to have a classroom where there was diversity, not just, I wanted racial diversity, and I wanted opinion diversity. And I think that for this stuff is not only that harmful, it's really good, and service academies recognize that. The whole thing just drives me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, me too. Me too. Now for the listener questions. James, they get better every week because people really are engaged. Cole in Huntsville, Alabama says, why are the Democrats so weary talking about the border?
Well, you got a week, Cole. So what happened is President Biden took office. And of course, he listened to the progressives, of which is literally 100% of the time a mistake. And if you remember, Bernie in 2020 was calling for open borders. This has always been a thing on the left that you had to open a border because it was you wanted that disorder or whatever. By the end of the day, the border was a place that was under control. I mean, we learned the hard way. We learned the real hard way. And of course, understand, people like immigrants. They don't like disorder. And the Democrats need to be the party of safety and order. Look what's happening in Newark ass space, all right? And I don't, there's a certain progressive revulsion against public safety that I frankly understand a little bit, but not totally. And anytime that there's disorder, it hurts us when we're in charge. And we have to just acknowledge that. And I would say never, ever, ever listen to the progressives, but be very wary and very skeptical when they come to you. Because Joe Biden's lived to regret it. A lot of other people have lived to regret it. The party's, you know, semi-embrace of the language of the identity left hurt us deeply and profoundly. It was really stupid. I mean, really indefensibly stupid. But we did it and we paid a price.
Yeah. James, I'm going to do something that I don't usually do. I'm going to steal a question from New Orleans. This is from Henry in New Orleans, who says, this is a good question. He said, I see strong cases for Biden being the best president due to results during his term and the worst in that he gave rise to Trump round two, which is more accurate. Well, first of all, he wasn't ever going to be the best. He didn't have any, you know, the kind of record that FDR had, probably even LBJ, but he would have been a good president. He would have left on a high. He would have been celebrated. He would have been recognized as a great bridge between the terrible Trump 1.0 and whatever followed, which I think if he had left when he should have, more likely would have been a Democrat. But he's going to go down, you know, as a much lesser figure because of his absolutely indefensible decision to run for reelection when the people around him knew that he was no way he was fit to serve 4 years. I think the new Jake Tapper book is just going to add to what we already know, and it's going to be devastating. And it's just it's a really, really one of the great tragedies, James, because Biden could have left on a high. Instead, he leaves on a low.
Oh, do I agree with you? Because this program, I guess I should be happy to say, was probably the most skeptical program there was, with a sort of left-leaning ideology, that Biden should not run for re-election. And it was difficult because personally, he's one of the most likable people. If you look at the totality of President Biden's career, I would argue is as accomplished as anybody since World War II. All right. Look, he had 4 years. What they got done in 4 years, and when he turned the keys over, what we had was pretty damn impressive. It was really impressive. And you look at what he did before as, you know, vice president. He was the first big Democrat to come out for gay marriage when he was vice president. His time in the United States Senate, Judiciary Committee, Foreign Relations Committee, everything. I mean, I think Joe Biden certainly deserves a rank among the good, even some, maybe one of the better presidents. If when you look back over history, certainly first term president. But, you know, he made one colossal, giant mistake. And it did not just cost the Democrats the presidency, which is horrible, horrific, particularly as Trump, but he cost himself a glorious retirement.
He did.
And, you know, you don't have to be coherent to cut a ribbon to open an airport terminal, a bridge, or a canal, or an overpass. And that's all he would have been doing if he would have gotten out in March of 2023.
For the rest of my life, it'll be just one of the tragedies I've ever watched.
It's going to be one of the great tragedies of all time. And, of course, all the people that never said anything, you know, now Pete Buttigieg is saying, well, it would have been better if he wouldn't run for re-election. Well, fuck, say something when it meant something.
Right.
But now, in retrospect, everybody's, oh, well, shit, we should have known.
Well, one thing they ought to say, and then I'll say right now, is, Joe, go to Rehoboth and Wilmington, get off of television. You are making a fool of yourself. You're planning some kind of counter to this Tapper book. That is the worst thing in the world, because you know what? You're not up to it right now, Joe. You once were. You're not now. Please, just go and, you know, take comfort in your friends and your family and stay out of the limelight. Speaking of Pete Buttigieg, Craig in Lake City, Michigan asked you, James, do you agree that Buttigieg's main weakness regarding electability is that he's gay, and is that a deal breaker?
I hope not. I can't tell you, but I hope not. I can't tell you. First of all, his electoral background is winning in South Bend, right, which is, I don't know, it's a college town, but it's got issues. And
about the size of Shreveport, maybe smaller.
Yeah. And he's got to really relate to Southern blacks. I don't know if he's being gay, how big an issue that is. I hope it's not. But it's there. It's part of his persona. I don't think anybody should be judged on it. But he's very good on TV. I don't know if he comes across the people as being, you know, presidential timber.
Presidential.
I don't know if it has anything to do with his sexual orientation. I hope it does.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I don't consider him one of the stronger Democratic candidates, though I do agree he's very good on television and he ought to be used that way. Thank you for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Harvest Hosts, Miracle Made, and ZBiotics in the episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast site. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.